Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are opening a text that didn't just record history, it pretty much invented it. This single book is the foundation for almost everything we think we know about King Arthur, Merlin, and, well, the whole idea of medieval chivalry.
We are diving deep into Geoffrey of Monmouth's absolutely monumental work, The History of the Kings of Britain, or Historia Regum Britanniae. And you're right, for centuries this was taken as basically gospel truth. Even today, its influence on storytelling is just, it's huge.
So our mission here is to unpack why this incredible act of myth-making, this, you know, pseudo-history, was so wildly successful. How did it fundamentally shape the cultural imagination of Britain? It provided an entirely fabricated, but as it turns out, incredibly useful national identity.
And that really is the core insight for us today, isn't it? The sheer power of narrative over, well, actual fact. This book wasn't written to meticulously record what happened. It was written to give the 12th century Anglo-Norman elite a glorious, usable past, something to cement their legitimacy by anchoring their rule in this ancient heroic lineage.
Right. Let's meet the architect of this grand fabrication then. Who was Geoffrey of Monmouth?
Geoffrey was, well, he's a really fascinating figure, active in the 12th century, born around 1095, we think. He ended up being a scholar, a cleric, and eventually the Bishop of St. Asaph. But crucially, he was based at Oxford for a lot of his key working period.
Okay, Oxford. So he's straddling different worlds there.
Exactly. He had one foot firmly in the formal Latin scholarly world. You know, the history books, the chronicles, how things were supposed to be written. But he was also Welsh, or at least deeply familiar with Welsh and Breton culture.
Ah, so he had access to all those floating Celtic oral traditions, the Bardic tales, King Arthur, local heroes, that sort of thing.
Precisely. Stories that were exciting, maybe known locally, but weren't written down in the proper Latin format. His genius was really in synthesis. He saw these incredible but kind of localized Celtic myths and realized they needed validation for a wider educated European audience.
And the language of authority back then was Latin Chronicle.
Right. So he takes these, frankly, dazzling Celtic tales and wraps them up in the respectable clothes of Roman-style history. But here's the most audacious move, maybe the most famous part.
Go on.
He claims he didn't actually write it. He insists he was merely translating a very ancient book in the British tongue, a book supposedly given to him by Walter, the Archdeacon of Oxford.
Okay, wait. He just made up a source.
Well, that's what virtually all modern scholars believe. That framing device is just genius political maneuvering, really, because it's almost certainly a fiction that grants instant authority to his fiction.
The ancient book probably never existed.
Almost certainly not. It was his way of saying, effectively, look, don't blame me if this stuff sounds wild. I'm just the translator, the messenger.
But isn't that a huge risk? Claiming a fake source. Why did people, especially learned people, buy it?
It sounds risky to us, yeah. But you have to remember the medieval mindset. Authority, especially ancient authority, often trumped empirical verification. Having a supposed ancient lost source was like, well, maybe like citing a foundational study today. It gave the work immense weight.
So the story was just so good, and the authority claim sounded convincing enough.
Exactly. People wanted to believe the glorious tale, and Geoffrey understood that. The risk paid off. Spectacularly so.
Okay, let's get into the book itself then, this Historia. The scope is massive, right?
Oh, absolutely huge. We're talking nearly 2,000 years. It starts, believe it or not, right after the fall of Troy and runs all the way up to the Saxon conquests in the 7th century CE.
And the central argument, the political thesis running through it.
It's audacious. Geoffrey's goal, fundamentally, was to establish Britain as historically equal to, or maybe even, you know, superior to Rome.
Wow. How does he even try to do that?
He needed a pedigree, a noble origin story. So he claims the British people descended directly from Trojan nobility, specifically through Brutus, the great-grandson of Aeneas.
Aeneas, the legendary founder of Rome.
The very same. So if Aeneas founded Rome, Geoffrey argues, his relative Brutus founded Britain. Suddenly, the Britons aren't just some conquered island people. They're cultural cousins to the Romans with their own ancient noble lineage.
That's That's quite a move. It instantly gives them cultural capital on the European stage.
Precisely. He wasn't just giving the Anglo-Norman rulers a history, he was giving them justification. A reason why they deserved respect, why they weren't just, you know, Norman conquerors on some remote island. It functioned as incredibly effective national propaganda, uniting different groups under this shared grand narrative.
So the basic story arc is Trojan Foundation, building a civilization, hitting this incredible high point with King Arthur.
Who gets about a fifth of the entire book, by the way. That's how central Arthur is.
Right. And then the decline, internal problems, and the Saxon invasions leading to the end of British rule.
It's a classic rise and fall structure, but the way he tells it, the details he includes, that's where the real invention happens. Beginning really sets the tone. It's pure fantasy almost.
It really is. You've got Brutus, guided by the goddess Diana, finding the island of Albion, but it's inhabited by giants.
Terrifying giants. He has to clear them out before he can found New Troy, which Geoffrey says becomes London.
And he needs a hero for that job.
Of course. Enter Corineus, Brutus's companion. He's the strong man who wrestles the chief giant, Gog Magog, a fantastic name, and chucks him off a cliff. Probably the cliffs of Dover, people think.
So right from the start, the British aren't just noble. They're physically powerful enough to defeat these monstrous primal inhabitants. He's inventing Britain's first superhero battle.
Absolutely. It's establishing mythic credentials. And he weaves in moral lessons, too. Think about the story of King Lear.
Shakespeare's King Lear. That comes from Geoffrey.
That's the primary source, yes. Geoffrey tells the story of Lear foolishly dividing his kingdom based on his daughter's flattering but false declarations of love. Only Cordelia is honest, and she gets disinherited. It's a powerful early warning in the book about weak leadership and betrayal causing chaos.
Okay, but the real historical audacity, the bit that really rewrites the past to elevate Britain, that comes later, right? With Belenus and Brennius.
Oh, yes. This is Geoffrey's ultimate flex, as you say. He needs to prove British superiority over Rome somehow. So he takes these two legendary British kings, Belenus and Brennius, and he has them unite their forces, conquer Gaul, and then audaciously sack Rome itself.
He claims the Britons sacked Rome.
Yeah.
But wasn't that the Gauls historically?
It absolutely was. Around 390 BC, Geoffrey just takes that famous event, a huge moment in Roman history, and attributes it entirely to his British heroes. Poof. Instant historical one-upmanship.
Wow. So he's basically saying, forget you Romans conquering us later. Our ancestors conquered you first.
That's the message. And that revisionist approach continues when he gets to the actual Roman period in Britain. Julius Caesar's invasions.
Yeah.
Geoffrey presents them as, well, failures, repelled by the brave British king Cassivellaunus. Britain, in his telling, is never truly subjugated. It might pay tribute sometimes, reluctantly, but it maintains its essential dignity and independence.
He's preserving British pride throughout the Roman era. But eventually things do fall apart after the Romans leave.
They do. And Geoffrey places the blame squarely on one figure. The weak, treacherous King Vortigern.
Right, Vortigern. He's the archetypal bad leader in this story.
Totally. His fatal mistake, according to Geoffrey, is hiring Saxon mercenaries Hengist and Horsa to help him fight off the Picts and Scots. This decision, born of weakness, is presented as the catastrophic moment the British basically invited their own downfall. Bad foreign policy leads to ruin.
And this crisis, this is where Merlin comes in, isn't it?
This is Merlin's grand entrance. Vortigern is trying to build a tower, but it keeps collapsing overnight. No one knows why.
Until they bring in the boy wizard.
Well, the boy prophet initially, Merlin, who reveals the problem isn't the engineering, it's magical. There are two dragons fighting in a pool beneath the foundations.
The famous prophecy of the dragons. The red dragon versus the white dragon.
Exactly. The red dragon representing the Britons, the white dragon representing the invading Saxons. Merlin foretells a long struggle, Saxons initially dominant, but ultimately the red dragon will rise again.
So it's this embedded prophecy of hope, a national destiny roadmap, assuring the Britons or their descendants, the Welsh, that their current troubles are temporary.
It's incredibly powerful political prophecy. And Merlin isn't just a prophet, he's the kingmaker. He uses his magic to engineer the conception of the future king, Arthur.
Right, the whole Uther Pendragon and Igerna affair, facilitated by Merlin's magic, setting the stage for the Golden Age.
And Arthur's reign is depicted as the absolute peak. The pinnacle of everything Geoffrey thinks British civilization could and should be, ideal kingship embodied.
He defeats the Saxons, establishes his court. Geoffrey places it at Caerleon, full of chivalry and splendor, marries Guinevere. But he doesn't stop there, does he?
Not at all. Geoffrey turns Arthur into this world-conquering European emperor figure. It's astonishing. He supposedly conquers Ireland, Iceland, Norway, Denmark, Gaul.
It's like a medieval wish list of conquests.
It really is. And the ultimate power move comes when the Roman emperor demands tribute from Arthur.
And Arthur says.
Arthur doesn't just refuse. He turns Geoffrey's own fabricated history back on them. He says, effectively, tribute. You owe me tribute. My ancestors, Belenus and Brennius, conquered Rome centuries ago.
Huh. Using the fake history to justify defying actual Roman power. That's brilliant.
It's the ultimate mic drop, built entirely on his own narrative. But of course, tragedy has to strike, just as Arthur is preparing to march on Rome itself.
Bad news from home. His nephew, Mordred, has usurped the throne and married Guinevere.
Exactly. Betrayal again. This forces Arthur to abandon his grand European campaign and return to Britain, which leads to the catastrophic Battle of Camelot.
The final showdown between Arthur and Mordred.
A mutually destructive civil war. It devastates the British nobility. Just like the story of King Lear warned, internal division, civil discord leads to ruin. The kingdom collapses from within.
But Geoffrey doesn't actually say Arthur dies at Camelot, does he? That's crucial.
Absolutely crucial. He provides the ultimate narrative escape hatch. Arthur, grievously wounded, is carried off to the mystical Isle of Avalon to be healed,
leaving the door open for his return.
Precisely. It's the birth of the king under the mountain myth, the idea of the once and future king who will return when Britain needs him most. That single, ambiguous detail allowed the Arthurian legend to survive and inspire hope for, well, 1,000 years.
Okay, stepping back then, let's talk themes. Yeah. What's the deep political purpose driving all this? Theme one seems obvious. Legitimacy through lineage.
Absolutely. Job number one for Geoffrey was establishing Britain's pedigree. Linking Britain to Troy wasn't just cool. It was a calculated political move to demand respect on the international stage, giving them a mythic past equal to Rome's.
And that's something you see everywhere, isn't it? Whether it's a nation or even a company or a family, people need those foundational myths. Stories that create a shared identity, a sense of pride, a reason why we matter.
Totally. It's about crafting that origin story. And theme two is clearly the ideal of kingship and unity. The whole book hammers this home.
Strong, virtuous rulers like Arthur bring glory and unity. Weak or treacherous rulers like Vortigern or foolish ones like Lear bring division, chaos, and ruin.
Right. The fate of the whole community, whether it's a kingdom or, you know, your local sports team, is shown to be directly linked to the character and the moral choices of its leadership. It's a timeless lesson.
And that quote you mentioned earlier about Arthurian Britain exceeding all others in riches, luxury, and courteous behavior. That's Geoffrey setting a benchmark, right? An ideal standard.
Exactly. It's not just history. It's a vision of what Britain could be under the right leadership. Which leads us to maybe the most important distinction, history versus heritage. Meaning, Geoffrey's Historia is, by modern standards, terrible history. It's full of inventions, anachronisms, impossible events, but it is spectacular heritage.
Oh, okay. The difference between academic fact and what a culture chooses to remember and celebrate about itself.
Precisely. Heritage is the story a culture tells itself about its past, often selective, often mythologized, but incredibly important for identity. We need to be able to separate the two, appreciate the cultural value of the heritage Geoffrey created, even while acknowledging it's not factual history.
Let's pull out some of those core ideas, those potent phrases or concepts from the book. The first one has to be that authority claim we discussed. Paraphrase, it's Geoffrey saying, I have taken the trouble to translate this ancient book.
Yeah, that simple claim, that framing device, was the key to getting his imaginative work accepted. In a world that revered ancient texts, pretending to be a translator gave him instant credibility. It made his inventions seem official, almost sacred.
Then there's the explicitly political message, the prophecy of the dragons. The red dragon will at first be afflicted by the white dragon, but in the end, the red dragon shall arise.
That's pure political hope packaged as prophecy. For the Welsh, who saw themselves as the descendants of Geoffrey's Britons, this was huge. It was a promise embedded in this authoritative history that their subjugation by the Saxons, and later the Normans, wasn't permanent. Restoration was destined. It fueled cultural resistance for centuries.
And the vision of the Golden Age itself, that quote about Arthur's court being the peak of civilization.
That sets the standard. It creates this aspirational image of British greatness, wealth, culture, courtesy, power, all achieved under Arthur. Every subsequent period could be measured against that Golden Age, usually found wanting, which itself can be a political tool.
Thinking about real-life applications today, Jeffrey's success in taking these kind of niche Celtic traditions and making them accessible and appealing to the ruling Norman audience. There's a lesson there, isn't there, about cultural integration.
Definitely. It's a model, in a way, for how multicultural societies can try to weave together diverse cultural threads into a single, compelling national story without necessarily erasing the original elements. He showed that synthesis can create something new and powerful.
And the other big application seems unavoidable. Political storytelling. The fact that this historia, this fiction, was accepted as truth for 500 years.
It just screams testament to the power of narrative, doesn't it? A compelling, emotionally resonant story, one that fulfills a need or flatters its audience, can often be far more influential than, you know, dry, objective facts.
Which means for us today,
we have to be critical consumers of narrative, whether it's news media, political campaigns, advertising, even historical accounts. We always need to ask, who is telling this story? Why are they telling it this way? And what power or influence do they gain if we believe it?
So my final takeaway really centers on that power of the story itself. Jeffrey's ultimate achievement wasn't writing accurate history. It was creating an enduring story. He demonstrated this incredible link between cultural memory, what we choose to remember and believe about our past, and political possibility.
How so?
Well, he filled a psychological need for people grappling with conquest and identity. He gave them a glorious past, and in doing so, he created characters and narratives, Arthur, Merlin, Avalon, that inspired generations of writers, artists, even kings and leaders. He proved that a really good story, skillfully told, can genuinely shape identity and maybe even alter the course of history.
That's a great point. And for my final thought, I'd echo that, but maybe focus slightly differently. The single most lasting, undeniable impact of Jeffrey's work is its role as the absolute fountainhead of the Arthurian legend as we know it. Without Jeffrey taking those scattered Welsh and Breton tales, translating them into Latin, adding his own considerable inventions, and framing it all as history, would we even have the legend of Arthur, Merlin, Guinevere, Avalon, Camelot in anything like the form we know today? Probably not. He's the reason those stories became central to British and indeed Western culture. He ensured their survival and explosion.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.